morning. My name is Travis Stearns. I'm here on behalf of Mr. Shoemaker, and I'm asking for 3 minutes for rebuttal time.
All right.
Appreciate the special set for this as well, so quickly after the argument was rescheduled. I know that it's hard to do this, and when folks are sick, it's great that you're able to do this for us. What I want to focus on is the first issue and the question of what happens when an investigator that's appointed by the court acts with malfeasance really against his duties. And I think that the court...
Of course, the trial court found that it wasn't prejudicial, even if there was some malfeasance.
Well,
right?
The trial court analyzes the materiality issue, and we don't take issue with that issue, or with the court's analysis, rather, of that issue. The materiality issue doesn't really go to the question of whether or not the investigator actually lied to the witness. It goes to whether or not that witness was material. I think you have to really look at the essentials of what due process means and not just analyze this on an evidential...
Well, the Silva case, which is what you're relying
yes.
on, has a prejudice analysis.
Absolutely.
And the way your brief is structured, you don't even talk about the fact that the trial court made a ruling. You're just kind of throwing it at us as if everything your client said was true.
Well, there's nobody contests any of the issues in this case, and so I don't know if there's any other version of the facts that this investigator showed up, did very little. Clearly, the court was involved at that point, but that didn't visit him again until after the trial.
But shouldn't we be examining the trial court decision?
I'm sorry, which...
Should there not be an assignment of error to the trial court's decision?
As to the materiality?
No. In other words, what are we reviewing? Okay, normally we're here to review the performance of trial courts.
Yes.
If you want to tell us what we're supposed to look at, that's done by making an assignment of error to the place where a decision was made that you wish to have reviewed. So that is the decision we're going to review, even though you did not assign error to it.
Sure.
And I think it's more helpful if you think of it that way, rather than just throwing at us a bunch of stuff from, you know, what you or your client says and expecting us to review that.
Well,
we have to look at the situation that presented itself to the trial court, don't we?
Well, absolutely. But the trial court sees all of the same evidence that I presented to you. I'm not sure that I've analyzed this in a way that's fatal.
Well, the trial court essentially determine that, well, you know, we don't need to get into this further because if there was malfeasance by the investigator, it was not harmful error.
Well, again, there's no question of whether if there was, because there was, and that's not the investigator.
We don't know that there was.
Well, I mean, if the state's domestic violence advocate is telling the court that this witness was instructed to lie to the court, I don't know how you get any closer to malfeasance than that. That is not just Mr. Shoemaker complaining. That's the state complaining. That clearly goes well beyond the question of whether or not something might have happened here. There's no issue that
but
something...
If you assume that happened, don't you also have to show it prejudiced your client?
Again, I don't know how you get past the question of an investigator who's been appointed to assist and the court making the finding, that the investigator was necessary.
Well, normally, for example, if the attorney breaches the standard of care, there's a second prong. You have to show it made a difference. Why is it different for an investigator?
Well, and I don't think it is, but I also think that our courts have been fairly clear about how important the investigative services are.
And what are you referring to, the Silva case?
Well, no. If you look at State v. NJ and State v. Brett, if you look at the performance guidelines that the Supreme Court adopted for attorneys, and I know that's not investigators, but if you look at those performance guidelines that were also adopted, it's very clear.
Well, why should we not think that you're trying to avoid the prejudice standard by your remarks that you've made thus far?
Well, I honestly don't think you need to. I think that this is so close. This is so problematic and so concerning that you don't need to do that analysis in this particular case.
Well, but what authority would there be for that? What cases said, well, when it's really a clear cut like malfeasance, that you just don't go to the prejudice prong?
Well, ANJ, I think, is probably the closest case to look at. ANJ is a case where the defendant confessed to the sex crime, and then the court then his attorney never bothered to do any sort of investigation in that case. And, of course, that case is the Grant County case that involves a number of other problems in terms of communication, like with this particular investigator as well. But that's the case where the court says even under those circumstances, even where there's a confession, there's still an obligation to do some sort of a investigation. And Brett is the same. ANJ affirms Brett.
Do either Brett or ANJ say sometimes the investigator's performance is so bad we don't care about prejudice?
Well, and again, so...
It seems to be your argument.
I think that this is a structural problem. I think we're not going to see this type of case again because, for God's sake...
Structural error is a very, very narrow class of cases in which you can't have harmless error. I've never seen anything like this fall into that category. Structural error is, for example, when there's an absolute denial of counsel. You cannot have counsel. We're going to go to trial tomorrow. You were arraigned yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
That's structural error. What authority do you have for the idea that this particular type of situation would fall into that category?
I think if we were to use the lawyer analysis, which is obviously there are cases, so it's easier to talk about that. But if we were to use the analysis that you can have a lawyer, but that lawyer is going to tell your witnesses not to come to court, is not going to perform the duties that that lawyer is supposed to have, I think that it would be the exact same analysis, that is that same as if you can't have a lawyer going forward. I don't think that there's any difference between those two types of analysis. And I also and I think that you can apply...
Are you saying the level of performance was so low it's as if he didn't have an investigator?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
So what you're saying then is that the trial court erred by moving to the prejudice prong. The trial court should have had a full evidentiary hearing to determine whether or not these things actually occurred.
Well, again, I don't think that there was any contest that these occurred.
Well, there wouldn't need to be, would there, if the trial court thought it didn't make any difference. I mean, the trial court is even in a more time-pressured situation than we are. And as you know, I mean, if we don't have to go through the – if we can resolve ineffective assistance of counsel on the prejudice prong, we don't go into whether it was low performance. So why should this be different?
You know, I think that you can also find that he was prejudiced by not having the investigator do the investigation that he had requested. I don't think that there's – I mean, I know I've felt that this is an incredibly serious structural problem, but I think you can also find that the prejudice prong was violated.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Stephanie Guthrie, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney for King County on behalf of the state. As to the investigator issue, first of all, the facts very much are in dispute and unknown. As Judge Becker pointed out, the court declined to hear from the investigator to get another side of the story because there was simply no prejudice here. And Silva is very clear that even when there is a complete denial of an investigator, you still have to show prejudice. And there is simply no prejudice here. The defendant has not alleged prejudice here. There are some amorphous allegations that the investigator didn't do what he wanted him to without specifying what exactly that was or what difference it would have made. And then there's this allegation through the witness that the investigator instructed her to lie, which would clearly be improper, but as the court had already decided to allow her to testify by Skype, which she did, and there's no indication that the evidence that came out through the witness was affected by the Skype testimony, there's simply no prejudice here. I want to touch briefly on the other issues just in case the court...
There's no indication the witness lied either, is there?
No, there isn't. It's very odd. It would be shocking for an investigator to have done what the witness said he did. It's certainly possible, but the court didn't have any need to investigate the facts because the lack of prejudice was so clear.
Counsel made reference to, testimony that the victim advocate for the state said that the investigator told the witness to lie. Is that?
The report from the witness, the defense witness, came through the advocate. The witness, Robin, was a defense witness, but she did not want to be contacted by the defendant directly, so the state kind of played an intermediary role. And so the witness reported to the advocate what the investigator had told her, and the advocate then presented that to the court the next morning, essentially on behalf of the defense witness. So it came through the advocate, there was no investigation. The witness herself was never asked about it directly, and the court declined to hear from the investigator because it simply wasn't relevant at that point. Just briefly, does the court have any questions about the
404B? I'm sorry, I forgot to start the clock.
Oh, I apologize. Whatever you think is appropriate.
About 7 minutes.
Sounds good. I just wanted to touch on the 404B issue and the prosecutorial misconduct issue in case the court has any questions. On the 404B issue, the defendant is not disputing the court's finding that the prior similar molestation of AK was relevant to prove a common scheme or plan, or that the prior molestation of NS, the charged victim, was relevant to prove lawful disposition. He's simply arguing that the probative value versus risk of unfair prejudice analysis was done incorrectly. And in these, I think it's very clear that those were done correctly in this case, given the probative value of common scheme or plan evidence when all we had in the charged case was NS. We had no witnesses. We had no physical evidence. We had delayed reporting. And that obviously the evidence of lustful disposition towards NS herself was highly probative, given that his defense was that there was no sexual motivation. And then all of the other prior bad acts came in either because the defendant explicitly asked for them to be admitted so that he could question the witnesses about them, or because he opened the door after being warned, which was the case of the testimony from Jackie that AK had reported to her being forced to watch the defendant rape Jackie. So it's very clear in the record. Some of it the defendant even elicited himself. Some of it he stipulated to, such as the physical abuse of MS, the brother, and the kicking of the dogs. That was in an exhibit to which he stipulated. So there was simply no error by the court there when the defendant was asking for this evidence to come in. The court did not err in allowing him to bring that in at his own request. As for the allegations of prosecutorial misconduct, the issue with jury selection, there was no misconduct there. It is not improper to question potential jurors for bias, either for or against the defendant regarding his pro se status.
Isn't that a comment on his exercise of his right to represent himself, his constitutional right?
Well, the jury already knew that he was pro se. They were told when the parties were introduced, the court told them. And the defendant has not assigned any error to that. I mean, it's fairly obvious when a defendant is representing himself.
But to question his motive. I mean, the questioning in this case is clearly suggesting that he has an improper motive for wanting to represent himself.
I don't think so. I disagree respectfully. I think that what the questioning was about here is that there is a valid reason why a defendant might choose to represent himself. It makes it, that on some level it might make sense that this is not simply a person who is so crazy they're acting, you know, against their own interests.
Why would the prosecutor ask the question with that motivation in contrast to the motivation I suggested?
Because we have case law telling us that particularly in pro se cases, the state on some level has to make sure that the jury can be fair. Whether bias either for or against the defendant.
Now, this is the first time I've ever heard a prosecutor argue that voir dire was conducted by the prosecutor to make sure the jury was fair to the defendant.
There's case law telling us that we have to, right? That it, particularly in pro se cases, less so when there's counsel. But the name of the case escapes me, but there is case law saying that, you know, if a juror expresses animus or bias against the defendant, and the defendant doesn't excuse that person.
Oh, but I mean, really, it's a stretch to read it in as if that were what was going on. I mean, in other words, the prosecutor isn't being helpful and educational in this. The prosecutor is waiting for the jury, the juror panel, to have things click and realize that what's going on here is that this guy is representing himself so that he can intimidate the complaining witness. And that you're suggesting that, you know, you're saying what could possibly be a good reason? Finally, when somebody comes up with the right answer, you know, then the prosecutor moves on. This is not suggestive of a benign and helpful purpose. So maybe a
I think
better
that, well, but I also think that when we look at, for example, later questioning with the particularly with the third round of jurors, because it was only a group of 14 and only a few of them made it onto the jury with the first issue, the first panel. But later, the prosecutor asked similar questions about why a defendant might choose to represent themselves and didn't get an answer about questioning the victim himself and didn't look for it and moved on to other things. I don't think it's any more improper than for a defense attorney to say, you know, why might an innocent defendant choose not to testify? I mean, there are a lot of questions we ask.
The prosecutor can ask that question in part here.
Why might an innocent person choose not to testify? Yes, I think so.
Do you have a case that says that? I thought prosecutors weren't supposed to comment on the defendant's exercise of that right.
Well, first of all, in voir dire, it's not clear whether the defendant is going to choose to testify or not, but I think it's proper.
Do you have a case that says a prosecutor can ask that?
No, Your Honor, I don't. I don't. I'm not on those particular facts.
I'm skeptical that that would be a proper question. I'm troubled by the line of questioning and the defense that's being offered here, too. It strikes me that when a defendant chooses to exercise a constitutional right, that should be free from comment by the prosecutor, both in voir dire and argument.
And yet for the prosecutor to not touch on that at all would be to potentially not identify bias on that issue, which is relevant. And in the later questioning, which didn't touch on...
What would be an example of an answer from the panel that would suggest bias?
For example, with the later panel, the question about why might a defendant choose to represent himself, juror number 68 said that she had a problem, that in response to that she said, I've got a problem with him representing himself. I think he's trying to manipulate the victim, and that juror was removed and the state did not object. So that was a valuable piece of information to come out that caused that juror to be removed for cause. And regardless of whether this court is...
And what was the reason why the court removed that juror for cause when that was said?
The defendant asked for her to be removed for cause and the state did not object. There was no discussion. The defendant did not articulate his reasoning. And the court did not require him to, but the state did not object, given her answers. And the bigger issue here is that even if the court worries that the prosecutor shouldn't have gone down that path, any potential prejudice could have been cured by an instruction had the defendant objected, which he didn't. And this whole problem could have been alleviated. And so for that reason, there was no prosecutorial misconduct, and the conviction should be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you.
Ah, yes. No, that's okay. It's only us today, so it's...
We're having an argument.
Yeah.
Oops, wait. This is not right either.
I'll go with 13.
It's actually 13 hours, I think. Okay, let's try this again.
You need to give me the time, otherwise I'll take the rest of the morning.
All right.
So it sounds like I should focus a little bit more on the voir dire question, and I do think... That can anybody think of a strategic reason why someone might choose to represent themselves in a child molestation case? First question. Well, who do you think is going to be asking the questions of the alleged victims? And then moving over, once one who is accused of doing the act, who is questioning them, and then moving on from that, is highly improper. I agree that it's...
Would an instruction after the first question have solved that problem?
Sure. So, you know, when misconduct occurs earlier in the case with opening statements and with voir dire, it becomes more problematic because the court hasn't or the jurors haven't heard the evidence yet. And I'm not sure at that point where that sort of bias gets steeped into the jurors' minds that this is why he's doing this can really be cured. I think that at that point we really are past.
Well, what about counsel's response, though? The state just answered and said that, you know, that this other juror's comment shows that the juror might be thinking exactly that and that it's important to get that out so that it doesn't pop up later as a problem in jurors not disclosing their bias.
I don't think it's ever the point or the role of the prosecutor to insinuate what watch out for that the role of defense counsel, whether it's an attorney or whether it's someone who's going forward pro se. I think it's incredibly problematic when these questions get asked, regardless of who it is that's representing him. And it's especially problematic when it is really suggested here that it's because he wants to further abuse the victims. And there's really no way, I think, to read this paragraph or this colloquy that the prosecutor has other than it's to suggest.
Well, how would that be elicited then if there's a juror who is thinking that, you know, and I don't think it is that far-fetched, really. I mean, for somebody who with some level of awareness or sophistication of what goes on in these cases to think he's here because he wants to stare her in the face and intimidate her and stop her from testifying against him. That's why he's doing this. How would you know that?
If Mr. Schumacher had felt that was important for him to get a fair juror, he would have asked that question. And that's the place for that question. It would not have been inappropriate for Mr. Schumacher to ask those questions. It is inappropriate for the prosecutor, and is especially inappropriate not only because the first question that was asked, but the follow-up question.
Well, do you know of any case that says that the prosecutor should avoid asking questions that might elicit pro-state bias?
No, we don't have a lot on voir dire, but any suggestion of denigration of counsel, and certainly there's a long line of cases along that line.
Well, there are for sure, and usually they do come up in closing argument.
Right. I mean, I think that Easter is one that I looked at. Lindsay certainly is another that I looked at. And these are all closing argument cases, of course. We've got not a lot of cases on voir dire, but I think you could find a number of cases that I cited in my brief, especially those two that I think would be helpful.
I don't know if something that's not a voir dire case would be particularly helpful, but thank you very much.
All right.
Okay, that concludes our argument for today. The court will be at recess.